When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to John Cardina about the new book, Lives of Weeds, Opportunism, Resistance, Foley. Lives of Weeds explores the tangled history of weeds and their relationship to humans. Through 8 interwoven stories, John Cardina offers a fresh perspective on how these tenacious plants came about, why they are both inevitable and essential, and how their ecological success is ensured by determined efforts to eradicate them. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So I would like to start by asking, how has this pandemic influenced you and your work?
In sort of different and conflicting ways. One, it caused my laboratory to mostly shut down for a while, and which made it very difficult to finish up a few projects. That we had, but those are slowly going on. We've been able to manage a graduate student defense dissertations, all that, mostly by way of internet. But also, it allowed me more time for writing, for contemplation. I'm able to access all the resources of a great academic library online. So I was kept busy in that way without the kind of interruptions and worrying about parking and all those kinds of things that we normally do on a university campus.
So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I was born and raised in Ohio, USA. I grew up on a little patch of land between two industrial areas, those two now have converged, and with urban sprawl, any urban land has been taken over. But at the time, it was considered the country, and we had a large garden, and about a kilometer away from home was a large woods, part of a large natural area, and I used to go there to hike. So I had the great advantage of learning about gardens, farms and gardens, because I worked on farms and we had a large garden. And then I also got to hike in the woods, which was some place where I spent a lot of my time growing up. And then I went to Ohio State University for my undergraduate degree. And I spent a couple of years overseas in West Africa, and came back and finished my PhD. At Penn State University.
And were you always so enticed with plants?
You know, strangely, I think because we had the garden, and of all that, there were six kids in the family, and for some reason, I was the one who, I guess, was interested enough or wasn't able to come up with good enough excuses to work in the garden with my father and mother. And so I guess that was something that just came natural for me, to work with plants. And I've had a curiosity about them and been tinkering with them for years.
And along your career journey, were there any mentors that really supported you along the way?
You know, strangely, there have not been any strong mentors. That was a frustration for me. I was sort of hoping for that. But I sort of felt like every place that I ended up, I was taking my own path. And there were certainly key people in my life that influenced my ideas and attitudes, but there was no one who really, you know, I'd say, oh, I looked up to and I wanted to do as they did.
And what would you tell our younger listeners and early career researchers and perhaps students who are studying biology and might consider a career in agriculture?
I would say that it's obviously essential. People like to eat. And there are so many issues of concern to society that touch on agriculture. It doesn't matter pretty much what your main area is, whether it's engineering or chemistry or biochemistry or math or physics, that, you know, all of those things, genetics, all these things have something to say about agriculture and food. And so I would say that it's a place to think about making some of the basic sciences or even social sciences give them some practicality to help solve problems, because we're facing some severe environmental constraints, and with climate change, agriculture is coming under increasing stress. And so whatever field of endeavor students want to pursue, somehow it connects to agriculture.
So your latest book is Lives of Weeds, Opportunism, Resistance, Foley. So can you tell us, how did you come to writing it?
Well, I studied weeds most of my life, working in the garden and on farms. I had this curiosity about weeds, but when I went to college, I had no interest at all in studying them, because you know, that wasn't the kind of thing that had much attraction. Because it just seemed like, weeds are sort of despised by most people, so why would you want to work with that? And I, in doing my PhD research on pesticide impacts on microorganisms, I just had to learn about the pesticides and learn about the reason farmers were applying them, particularly herbicides. And that led me back to weeds, which, like I say, I had pretty much been studying most of my life anyways. And the more I got to know weeds and work with farmers or the general public, gardeners, whatever, I found a couple of things. One is that everyone has a connection to weeds. I can't believe the number of times people find out that I studied weeds and, oh, they've got a story about this weed or that weed, or their great aunt used to use this one, or they baked pie out of that, the seeds from that one. So everyone has a connection with weeds, whether they know it or not. And so I thought, I've been exploring this notion that actually, there is this big connection between humans and weedy plants. And the more I explored that, the more I saw this is an area that has hardly been touched in the literature. There are many books about weeds, and of course, there are books about agriculture and people's need for food and all that. But to bring those two together was something that I thought would be unique, and to explore that, the connection between the people and the plants that they sort of love to hate.
Yes, I'm really loving the way you shift this perspective of weeds from being on the side to being protagonists in the story.
Right. Well, so that's interesting. Yeah, the weeds are at the center of the story, but weeds are at the center of a lot of social issues and environmental issues, certainly about the way we produce food, the kind of food we eat, just the way that our choices and how we manage the environment. These are, and of course, the whole controversy about GMO food, most of that is all because of weeds. And so that's what I was, I'm not trying to promote weeds in any way, but I thought it was an interesting intersection there that most people are not too aware of.
So in your book, you cover a lot of really interesting science. So let's delve into some of it. And we can start from the very basics. Can you describe what is a weed?
Somehow I knew you might ask that question because that is a question that comes up all the time. And it's actually, that's the other thing that I find when people find that I learn that I study weeds. Immediately they give me a definition of what a weed is, as though, you know, I've been working with them for 40 years and, you know, and that I need to be informed what they think a weed is. A weed, is, in my view, is very much in the eye of the beholder. If you think it's a weed, then I will grant you that it can be a weed. There's no botanical, straight botanical definition of a weed. We can't look at a plant and say, oh, that's a weed, unless it's behaving in a way that we dislike, and then we can give it that name. The word weed actually has a long derivation that was actually at one time used for people. Shakespeare referred to weeds with respect to people and their stories of weeds in the Bible and all that. So weeds have been around a long, long time. But many philosophers and scientists have tried to come up with a very discrete answer for what is a weed, and most have not come up with anything satisfactory. The common definition is a weed is a plant out of place. A group of molecular biologists early on looked at weeds and their, you know, genetic changes that have occurred during the evolution of weeds, and pretty much decided that there is no other place for weeds but where they are. So there was not like this place where there used to be no weeds and suddenly the weeds came in. So and the other common definition goes back to Ralph Waldo Emerson in the 1800s, where he said, weeds are plants whose virtues have yet to be discovered. And I don't like that definition particularly, because most weeds have many virtues that are very well known. And so most of the weeds that I talk about in the book also have medicinal or practical uses that have been very well characterized, and yet they're still weeds. So that definition doesn't work. So I think that a weed is a plant that is a product of biology and human behavior that's become adapted to human activity, and it behaves in a way that's disagreeable. It's not a very clear definition, I'm sorry.
No, fascinating. So it's very context dependent, as I understand. So how did our relationship begin with weeds?
Well, it goes back to the very beginning of agriculture, of settled agriculture. As soon as people, early people realized that they could encourage the growth of desirable plants, maybe tubers or bulbs or things like that, that they desired, and they realized, oh, they could actually collect these and bury them, and they would come up again. Probably this was found around, this discovered around, you know, trash heaps that, you know, you throw pieces of the food plant away, and then lo and behold, it appears again the next year. And there's a belief that women in particular were the ones who first domesticated crops by collecting the seeds and collecting the tubers and so forth, and placing them in the ground, and realized that they could encourage them to grow. Well, as soon as you do that, you can't just leave those plants there, because when you come back, that place is just going to be full of plants that you don't like. And they found very early on that if they removed the undesirable plants, that the desirable ones would grow better. And so those undesirable plants became weeds, and they struggle to remove them from crops began, at least, you know, with early agriculture hundreds of thousands of years ago.
So how were weeds interconnected with the agricultural revolution?
Right. Well, there's a popular notion that it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek notion, I think. Michael Pollan talked about it, and Harari talked about it, and other anthropologists have talked about it, that plants like potatoes or apple trees essentially demanded the activity of humans to spread the genes of those plants around, and that is where domesticated agriculture began. In my view, domesticated agriculture began at the beginning of the beginning of the agricultural revolution, began when the first hoe touched, or sharp stick touched the ground to remove weeds so that the crops could grow. Just planting seeds was never going to be sufficient for successful agriculture. Farmers had to keep returning to the spot where they planted seeds to remove the weeds. And that required people to stay in place rather than being nomadic. And someone had to stick around and keep the weeds out of the fields so that the crops would grow. And that's the connection between weeds and the agriculture revolution.
So as we progress through the ages, people realized that they had to manage weeds somehow. So what kind of ways were invented?
Well, so some people say this is the great struggle of humanity since the beginning of the agriculture revolution, is to keep weeds under control so that crops will grow and we can feed larger and more complex societies. So there are all manner of things that have been used to control weeds. Obviously, initially, things like fire, physical manipulation, sharp sticks and sharp stones, rudimentary tools like that, animal grazing, and then it was very early on, people started using things like salt. The stories of I don't know my ancient Greek very well, but there's stories of civilizations there where, you know, one army would dump salt on the land of the other, and so the crops wouldn't grow. But then they realized, hey, we could use this to control weeds. So salts of all sorts were used for a long time. You can imagine that the labor of pulling weeds by hand, or even just with rudimentary tools, is not especially, you know, highly valued or desired. Nobody wants to do that. So they're, you know, looking around for all kinds of things to make that the labor easier. And the idea of, geez, if I could just throw something on the soil here to keep the weeds from growing, would make my life easier. And so, like I said, they use salts, and then in the as more complicated chemicals were developed, particularly with the advent of organic chemical synthesis, then people started using all kinds of things, petroleum-based products to control weeds. And of course, now, in conventional agriculture, highly technical, formulated herbicides are the main approach. But of course, there's still many farmers who refuse to do that and go back to using older methods.
And are there also genetic engineering approaches? For example, many would be familiar with the herbicide Roundup.
Right. So I didn't catch the first part of your question. Are there?
So what about genetic engineering?
Sure. Right. Well, the point of the first use of genetic engineering in developing GMO crops, well, actually, the early work began in the late 70s and through the 80s, but in the 90s, they were able to modify a particular gene in a soybean plant so that farmers could spray glyphosate, or the commercial name at the time was Roundup, on the soybean, and the soybeans would tolerate it because it had a modified gene from a soil bacterium that could function just perfectly well in the presence of Roundup. And so they found a way to insert that into the soybean cell and into the seeds. And farmers considered this nearly miraculous that they could plant soybeans. And previously, the herbicide killed all the weeds, every plant that it touched. But now it could continue to kill all the weeds, but the soybeans would continue to grow. And like I said, initially, this just looked miraculous. And since that time, they've continued to do that with to make crops resistant to other chemical herbicides. But the Roundup one is the main one where that's where the whole GMO technology was developed.
And as you note in your book, this puts selective pressure both on plants, but also on weeds, so having different herbicides. And you propose this new term, agrostal selection, if I'm pronouncing correctly. So can you tell us what does it mean?
Right. So I invented the term. It isn't that fancy, really. Agrestal selection. Agrestal is a word that means of the field, refers to agricultural fields. And practices, including herbicides, but not limited to herbicides, that humans impose on weed populations in agricultural fields. And after repeated use of a particular practice, those weeds that have a genetic potential to survive that will be the ones that produce seeds and appear there the next year. So regardless of the method you use to control weeds, over time, we seem to be selecting for weeds that are more and more difficult to control. And of course, with a herbicide, where the herbicide is attacking many times just a single enzyme, then finding a mutation in that weed population that can tolerate, so that those plants can tolerate that herbicide, is, we find, strangely, is not as uncommon as was once thought. But the same thing actually happens with respect to tillage, for example. If you till early in the season, then the plants that are able to wait out that tillage and come in later in the season are the ones that will be favored, because they're the ones that will survive. So I call that aggressive selection. It's essentially natural selection, but it's with all the rules of Darwinian selection. But it occurred because it occurs in agriculture. The pressures that are imposed by humans as in an agricultural setting. So neither the pressures nor the setting are natural. So I thought, well, natural selection might be confusing. So I thought, well, aggressive selection describes it more clearly.
So it's very much human imposed as compared to natural.
Yes. That's the difference. The natural selection, well, it can occur out in the wild without human influence. That's how evolution was for millions and millions of years. But once humans came in and started imposing selection pressure, then things changed. And so that's what I'm referring to there. And of course, herbicides are the most maybe extreme and easiest example of that to understand.
So in your book, you introduce us to 8 plants that have been labeled weeds, at least at some point. So how did you choose those 8 out of many, I suppose?
Sure. I chose those because I thought that they represented different aspects of this association between humans and weeds. And so they, and in that way, each weed represents sort of a different path to weediness. And also because I worked with all those, each of those species, and has some kind of personal connection. After all, if I'm going to write about the connection between people and weeds, I mean, I'm in the category people most of the time, so I figured that I needed to put myself into there too. So I have my own personal story of my connection to the weeds is there. And then also the weeds follow a trajectory of severity and maybe scale of impact on people, from some that I hardly consider important to some that are affecting and responding to global change. So that's why I chose those weeds. There, I started out with a longer list, but I had to bring it down to a manageable number. And in each species, in each case, I also found a way to teach a little bit about plant ecology. In each one, I tried to bring out a different area of things like seed dormancy, photosynthesis, floral biology, vegetative reproduction, basic genetics, things like that. So that it's, in a way, some people have said, oh, you know, why didn't you write it as a textbook? Well, I wanted it to be what I think more interesting than a textbook. So I have one little piece of weed biology, plant biology in each of those eight that I think are represented well by those species.
So the first plant you talk about is dandelion, and I was surprised that it was called weed. I never knew that. So can you give us a bit more of an insight into what it is?
Wow. Well, in the United States, dandelion is, I mean, probably the most widely known plant that is considered a weed. Anytime, you know, when I talk about weeds, people will say, oh, I have this problem with dandelions. What do I do about it? You know, personally, I don't think I'm with you. I don't really consider dandelion to be a weed. And if it is, it's not very important. But Americans are very, status conscious, and dandelion is a very socially constructed weed that really is a weed that shows that a weed is, it can be a reflection of cultural values. People want a lawn in front of their house that has no weeds, and dandelion, you know, has a yellow flower in the springtime, and then they turn white, and people consider that to look unsightly. And what I find strange about that is, first of all, there are many weeds out there, and yellow-flowered plants that they would put in their flower garden that I don't think look very much different than a dandelion. And those are highly prized and desired. Yet the dandelion that grows freely, for some reason, they have a big concern about that. So people would come to me and ask how to control dandelions. And I, many times I just asked, is it really doing any harm? You know, is it? Because dandelions, they're not poisonous. They don't hurt anyone. They don't have thorns. They don't really, in my view, do any harm. Not like an agricultural weed that is, interfering with an economic activity like crop production. But people really hold up this aesthetic of the perfectly green lawn. And so they're willing to spray herbicides, particularly 2,4-D and other things like that. They'll spray those on their lawn, even though there are known health hazards of 2,4-D. 2,4-D is also very toxic to bees, that can kill fish if it gets in the groundwater. It has all kinds of potential environmental impacts. The neighbors walk through your yard right after you've planted in 2,4-D. The kids walk through there. They walk and then go into the house, so they carry 2,4-D with them. It seems like they're taking a huge risk, but for some reason, they must consider it worth it. And so the way I have looked at it is, this shows the power of a weed to make people do things that are potentially harmful. But because the weed is a socially constructed entity with, you know, particular cultural values, people are willing to behave that way. So in a sense, the dandelion influence human behavior.
Yeah, I was thinking that nowadays you can even get dandelion leaves grown for food. So do you think there's a potential that it will be at some point relabeled from being a weed to being a commercial plant?
Well, there are many places that sell dandelion. Well, the problem is common names are confusing. Many in the grocery stores here, we many times see something called dandelion, but that is not the same species as the weed. That's usually a cicorium. It's like a chicory, whereas the dandelion, the taraxacum, is something different. They're very closely related, and they both have yellow flowers, but what the dandelion greens that most people eat here are not truly dandelion. To find a dandelion plant in the U.S., my grandfather used to make dandelion wine, but that was before people were spraying their lawns all the time. But nowadays, it's precarious to find a dandelion and try to, unless you know that you've managed it yourself. But right, it has great nutritional value and it can be eaten. It's a little bit sour once it gets too big, but, it has food value. The roots also can be dried and ground and used. But it's like all weeds have that. All weeds have some kind of utility. Yet the social norms are that you can't have the yellow flower and then the white puffs, seed puffs in your yard. And so people are willing to do all kinds of things to get rid of them.
Oh, gotcha. So I won't be picking up dandelions on my walk for my salad.
Not in the U.S.
So another weed, which is much less familiar to me, that you cover is the velvet leaf. And it's a distant cousin to cocoa?
Well, it's in the same family, right? That's a very complicated family, the Malvaceae, that has been reorganized by taxonomists several times, but in the most recent reorganization, right, they've put, it's very more closely related to crops that people would be familiar with, like perhaps okra and cotton, flowers like hibiscus, things like that, and then linden trees, and for some reason they put the cocoa trees into that same group. But if you look at a cocoa pod, if you've ever seen one growing on a tree, it does have a resemblance. If you use your imagination, it has a resemblance to sort of a bloated okra. And that seed, that is, and if you compress that down, it would look like the velvet leaf seed capsule. So there is a morphological similarity in those. And I guess that, geneticists now have found that there actually is some kind of a connection, enough that they lump them together into the same family. But plant families can be quite diverse and, hundreds of species.
So how did velvet leaf earn its designation as a weed?
Right. Well, it was used in China in ancient times as a crop to make rope. Now, I originally didn't think much of rope, but if you consider rope was an essential early invention of early people, because rope is like string. It's used to tie up things. It's used to put together for clothing. It's all kinds of uses to carry, to haul, to put, many people together using rope can move great boulders. So it was really an essential part of early society in China. And so the velvet leaf was one of the plants that was used because it has these long, long fibers in the stem, and it's, which it would tell you that it has a very tall plant. And another plant that people would be more familiar with as a rope-making plant is hemp. And somehow the two plants, velvet leaf and hemp, got tangled together someplace between what's now China and what's now Russia. And the two of them were used together for making rope. And the hemp is finicky and a little more difficult to grow. And so, well, you know, in the markets, people would throw a little bit of velvet leaf stems in there and nobody knew the difference. And so the two traveled together. And then in the early days of the beginning of the United States in the 1700s, people were incredibly, the international commerce was incredibly dependent on rope because they used sailing ships. And so these ships had miles and miles, could be 5 or more miles of rope on the ships, some great big diameter to pull up a great big heavy anchor. So rope was an essential commodity for trade and, of course, for the navies. Any country needed to have a source of rope for shipping, and early on in the days of the United States, George Washington wanted to stimulate the domestic economy, and so he put a tariff on rope. Rope crops would be grown in America rather than imported. And that was a little bit of a problem because the American grown versions were not very good. They weren't managed as well as the rope that came from Russia, the hemp came from Russia. And that was what brought the hemp seeds and velvet leaf seeds into the U.S. And at that time, they were both still considered crops. And so when Washington put, with the help of Alexander Hamilton, imposed this tariff, he essentially was promoting the spread and dispersal and growing and actually genetic adaptation of what would become a major agricultural weed, which is velvet leaf, and a plant that would become a major illicit drug, which is marijuana. So I don't think Washington had any idea that that's what he was doing at the time. But then once it was recognized that the quality of rope from velvet leaf was not very good, it was essentially abandoned. But they had already spread seeds all over the place. And then when it appeared in farms and gardens, it became a cursed weed. Even though for many years there were many attempts to revive it and as a crop for different purposes, not only rope, but for all kinds of things, different chemicals that could be extracted from the seeds or the stem. It has actually a very sticky stem once it's mature, and the material that is in the sticky hairs can be used to deter insects. So people have tried to extract that and use it as an insecticide. There are all kinds of attempts to do that and to get farmers to grow velvet leaf. And most of the time, farmers know well enough that this is not something that they want to keep planting in their fields. And so it never became an important and crop. And then once soybeans came in as a major crop to the United States, originally it was used as a forage crop, but when it was then discovered its use as an oil crop, then velvet leaf became the most important weed, annual weed in soybean production, because the two both came from China. They came from the same area of China. They were adapted to the same soil, the same environmental conditions. And at the time, there were no good controls for velvet leaf. So that's how it became a major weed.
So how do you see our relationship with weeds evolving in the future? For example, when we have hydroponic farms, can we move away from this eradication mindset?
Well, I'm skeptical of hydroponics as a way to for future agriculture, just because of the energy demands. But people have tried to convince me that actually it does make sense. Right. The weeds that we're used to dealing with would not be a problem in hydroponics. I think with as long as the water is moving, that the only weed problem might be algae or things like that. I don't know that hydroponics is really the future of food production. I sort of doubt it, but I could be wrong. And if it is, then right, then those in that respect, weeds wouldn't be so much of a problem. But still, we're going to be producing some crops in fields and on farms. I would hate to see a day when you know everyone had moved inside and we no longer went outside and had people will always want to have gardens, and they'll always want to have places of beauty and grow their own vegetables and things like that. I'd much rather have my own. Grow my own vegetables and to grow something that was hydroponically grown.
Yeah, for sure. Unless it's somewhere on Mars. So now thinking about the bigger picture, what would be the key implications of exploring this field for our society?
Well, I think I'm not, like I say, I'm not expecting that I'm going to be encouraging people to study weeds or to maybe to have a little more respect for weeds and the amazing things that they do. But what I'm mostly want to explore is this connection that we have to the natural world. And weeds are just one component of that through which we can learn about the natural world. And I think if we had more understanding of how weeds behave when they first developed the GMO crops, that the whole problem of resistance could have been avoided, but that's speculation, I suppose. But I want readers to see that actually they are connected to weedy plants. They're connected to the natural world through weedy plants, and that the way we manage, the way we treat the environment has a big impact on this, our relationship with plants, and particularly plants like weeds that are very closely associated with human activity. So it's mostly, it's trying to encourage some greater understanding of that connection, our connection to the natural world.
Oh, yes, for sure. That's so important. I always have my app for plant identification when I'm outside. So what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, Lives of Weeds, surprised you the most?
Right. When I was writing Lives of Weeds, I knew about the weeds from mostly from a agricultural and biological perspective. But I didn't in a general sense. But when I started exploring the sociological connections, the environmental connections, the natural history, those kinds of connections, I was surprised, first of all, to see how ancient many of these plants are, and some of them, and then others like ragweeds and mare's tail were hardly considered weeds at all until just really a few years ago, but only because of the pressures, the aggressive selection that humans imposed made them into weeds very quickly, whereas something like nutsedge was known to be a weed, you know, thousands of years ago. So what I came down to learning is that, you know, weeds would not be weeds without humans and human activity, and humans would not be, we wouldn't be who we are without weeds. We've responded to each other. Like I said, the more we try to control them, the more they respond. We're selecting the genotypes that tolerate our conditions, so we change our practices, and then the weeds in turn respond. So there's this back and forth, and it's that back and forth, that so co-evolutionary, if you will, interaction that surprised me the most.
So do you allow different weeds to grow in your garden? And have you tried counting the number of species that you have?
I do let a few weeds grow in my garden. The ones that are edible, they're usually edible for a short period of time, like purslane and lamb's quarters, but if they get too big and they are able to set seed and take over the area, I don't like that. That because then I start having to pull them out, so I don't reduce production of other things that I'm growing. I'm very lucky, because when you have an area, a farmed area where you don't let the weeds go to seed for many years, you can really reduce the impact of those weeds. So I do let some go, because I enjoy them. And that's the thing. It depends on if some that I let go, I don't consider weeds, and other people would consider it. But it just depends on our point of view, I suppose.
Maybe just allocate a small plot in your garden to attract some of the insects as well.
Well, right. That's the other thing. So it's like milkweeds. I mean, they're farmers will spray milkweeds and try to get rid of milkweeds. But there are, three, maybe five species of milkweeds. And they're beautiful. So I plant them on the outside, and I try to encourage the pollinators, the butterflies, to come there. There are a few others like that in the carrot family that I let grow because they support the swallowtail butterflies, things like that. So I have a little area that I actually several areas that I like to encourage particular weeds to grow, so that, because I know that they're favorable for pollinators. But as far as me counting the weeds in my garden, no, I've done enough of that in my garden.
Well, this has been truly fascinating discussion. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
So right now I'm exploring ideas for a book on invasive plants of natural areas rather than weedy plants of crop fields. I make a distinction between those. I know that the distinction isn't really clear, but I think that there are enough differences that it makes sense to differentiate those. And what I'm dealing with is that the problems with invasive plants in natural areas is maybe more complicated than for weeds in agriculture. Farmers don't disagree on which weeds are weeds. Okay, everybody knows pigweed is a weed. Okay, they might disagree on how to manage it. That's where the big environmental concerns come in. How, you know, do we spray? Do we do tillage? Do we risk soil erosion? What do we do? Whereas for invasive plants, there isn't even agreement on whether a plant is invasive many times. And there's our commercial interests that are selling plants that some people believe are invasive. And I don't want to enter the argument. In my book, Lives of Weeds, I think you would notice, I don't take a side in the controversy about agriculture, GMO crops, all that kind of stuff. I respect all sides, and I'm trying to stay neutral. So that's the same thing with invasive plants. But if I call something an invasive plant, I know there will be people who want to argue with me about that. So I'm trying to navigate that territory gingerly and just talk about the biology, which I think is the most fascinating part. And you know, I'm a biologist. I want people to appreciate the wonder and beauty of the natural world, not to be distracted by petty arguments. So that would be my next project that I'm walking into very carefully.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, the book, of course, is index. You can get it. You can search for Lives of Weeds and my last name, Cardina, Cardina, on Google or Amazon. It's available as a digital copy. It's available as an audio file, and of course as a hard copy in paperbacks from Cornell University Press. And so, as for information about me, I've never tried to look up information about me, so I don't know. But I'm assuming if you Google me, you'll find my information from my work at Ohio State University.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've truly learned a lot.
Thank you. It's been great speaking with you.